Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 225. What changes are happening under the hood in the latest versions of Python? How are these updates laying the groundwork for a faster Python in the coming years? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week, bringing another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher shares an article about Python's recent performance improvements. The piece covers the specialized adaptive interpreter and explains what those terms mean. It also includes details about the experimental feature of the just-in-time compiler added in 3.13. We dig into a collection of Django projects you can use to practice and develop your skills. The projects ramp up from detailed beginner tutorials to more advanced projects with guidelines on how to get started. We also discuss a collection of popular websites that use Django. We share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a batch of recent Python enhancement protocols, a couple of Python releases, using DuckDB in the browser with Pyodide, building a contact app with Textual, generating a tiny status page with a Python script, and a grep-like tool that understands code. This episode is sponsored by Assembly AI. Assembly AI's API gives you instant access to accurate speech-to-text models and advanced insights. Try it for free at assemblyai.com/realpython. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey there, been a while.
Yeah. It may not seem like it from our feed, but we've both been doing multiple things. I had a nice little trip in between the release of Python there, which was great, but I'm excited to get going.
Doing multiple things is code for I hung out on a beach, whereas the rest of us were working. So, yes.
Sorry. I had to do it. It was for family.
Ah, there you go. That's a horrible thing. Yes.
Yeah. Well, we got quite the list of peps. I was going to say the peppy news for the week, along with some more details about the 3.13 release that has happened now. You ready to dig into some news?
Yeah, for sure. It's been 4 weeks since we've done a PyCoders episode, and you would expect then that there'd be tons of news, but most of the news has come from the last issue, so we'd still be in this situation one way or the other.
Right.
As you said, a lot of it is peps, lots and lots of peps. There's five of them that I'm going to talk about. The first one is entitled PEP 777, which is how to reinvent the wheel. This is part of the standards track, which means it doesn't really change anything. It just sets the rules for things that might come in the future. So the wheel is one of the packaging formats that Python supports. It has replaced other kinds of packages. So you may have seen eggs in the past. When you do pip install, in all likelihood, what you're doing is fetching a wheel and using that to install. The spec for wheels was written in PEP 427, which gives you an idea. So that was 350 peps ago. It was first proposed in 2012. I'm surprised we did anything in 2012. It was the year the Mayans said the world would end. Anyways, I know that's not true. Don't write angry letters.
Yeah.
So PEP 777 outlines the rules for future changes. It doesn't actually say this is a new version of a wheel, but specifies what kind of backward compatibility is required if a new wheel PEP is proposed. So sort of a meta PEP, and it means people are thinking about this stuff to limit breakage in the future. The next two PEPs kind of go together. 758 is titled Allow Accept and Accept Star Expressions Without Parentheses. Right now, if you have a try accept block and you want the accept portion to handle multiple exceptions, you have to write them in parentheses. The idea in this PEP is to allow a comma separated list, but without the parentheses, which in theory should make things a little easier to read and there's less typing and it's more consistent with other parts of the language that kind of behave this way already. When 758 popped up, there was a sort of response in another PEP, which referred to itself as 758's evil twin. This was PEP 760, which is titled No More Bear Accepts, and it proposed getting rid of the ability to have an empty accept clause that catches everything. You would have to use the exception class and essentially be explicit about it. You may have caught that I've been talking about this one in the past tense, and that's because a couple of days of discussion about how much this would blow backward compatibility, the proposers withdrew the PEP. This happened in less than a week, so depending on how frequently you get your Python news, the withdrawal notice might have been the first time you saw anything about this PEP.
Yeah, it's funny. It's the same authors as the other one.
Yep.
So I guess that's part of the evil twin thing you're saying.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The next one, PEP 735, is titled Dependency Groups in PyProject TOML. This was created last year and proposes a new way of storing named groups of package dependencies inside a PyProject TOML file. This one recently got approved, and it says if you want to have dependencies only for testing, you could have a group named, say, test, which includes, say, greater than Django 5.0, for example. This is a packaging PEP, which means it doesn't actually change the language. So it's a standard that your favorite packaging tools may or may not get around to supporting at some point in the future. But it's nice to have these because we have all sorts of packaging tools, and this kind of PEP causes consistency. It just sometimes takes a while for them to trickle down. And all right, four down, one to go. PEP 761 is titled Deprecating PGP Signatures for CPython Artifacts, and this is a process PEP. Right now, CPython release artifacts are signed with both PGP and SIG store digital signatures. If approved, this PEP would mean that future artifacts will only be signed with SIG store. This makes key management for the Python release manager easier and should come into effect in next year's Python 3.14 release if it gets approved. So that's the PEP news. Now let's talk releases. Since we last got together, Python 3.12.7 was released, and it contains a series of bug and security fixes. So if you're on 3.12, go get that. And then finally, although we've talked about Python 3.13 in its own dedicated episode, we'd be remiss if we didn't touch on the little bit of complexity that happened with this release. Python 3.13 went out the door on October 7th, which was a week later than originally planned. 3.13 had some changes to the garbage collector that were meant as performance improvements, but late in the release candidate process, it was discovered that there were issues being caused by the change. The Sphinx library in particular was seeing a 40% performance regression. Changes to the garbage collector are always going to kind of be good for some people and bad for others. You're either going to, you might get some performance improvement, or you might get cost of memory or slower or edge cases, but 40% is a lot.
Yeah.
And it was decided to back this out. So release candidate 3 came out on September 30th, which was the original goal instead of the gold copy. And then the final release came out on October 7th. We'll link to the discussion group where the problem was brought up, which itself contains links to the commits if you're really curious as to exactly what got yanked at the last minute here. And now that we've covered the news, I think that's all the time we have, right? Did you have something you wanted to say in your podcast?
Sure. Actually, I wanted to mention one thing about wheels, kind of going back to the top of the news there. We had an article on Real Python by Brad Solomon. I always love the name of it. What are Python wheels and why should you care? So it's always one of my favorite ones. And I know that we talked about it at the time on the show. So if you're interested in digging in a little bit deeper and understanding some of the background behind it, that might help as you learn more about the PEP.
Yeah, it's a great article. I remember digging into it. It taught me an awful lot. It was one of those things I was like, yeah, whatever. It's a package. It's magic. I don't need to know the magic. But there's a lot of thought that went into it.
Yeah. And then, it kind of gives a little bit of that history too of the egg and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Some of these other interesting things. So cool. It digs us, like you said, into topics. And we have a kind of a bit of a theme that's a little more leaning toward projects and places for people to practice their Python skills. My first one is an article by Alex Monahan. It's titled DuckDB in Python in the Browser with Pyodide, PyScript, and JupyterLite. He has like a TLDR little subheading, Run DuckDB in an in-browser Python environment to enable simple querying on remote files, interactive documentation, and easy-to-use training materials. It's kind of funny he uses that at the end, but he actually really starts with this focus about if you want to tackle exploring like a new library, very often the first thing you're going to do is set up a hello world sort of example. And how quickly can you get to a hello world is always a bit of a problem. And if you're someone looking at documentation, or you have somebody else who's looking at documentation that you've written, you want to be able to get them up to speed with the tool and preferably able to run and load the tools that you're working with so they can follow along with the examples. What's funny is he then has links right into his own article with running code examples in the article, which kind of gives you a heads up as to what this is about and kind of give you an idea. But anyone who has taught before has, especially if you're teaching something like Python, you've experienced how this can become demo hell, and be it like a workshop or a classroom, or maybe you're just the one presenting at your local meetup. Making sure that people can follow along is hard and can be a huge time suck, be it, are they on Mac? Are they on Windows? Are they on Linux? Is it a data science setup? Are they using Conda, or, you know, our favorite new toy, UV? Is Python actually installed? Okay, well, how is it actually installed? And how are they managing environments? And we harp on this a lot, but it's critical and it's a huge time suck if you're just trying to make a presentation and have people follow along. So he offers some other solutions that have been around. I mean, obviously there's local installation, which we talked about all the trouble there. And one of the things that Alex touches on briefly is, well, you could have a server-side Python somewhere it's set up in the cloud. And if you've ever tried to do server-side Python, it has its own special challenges. You know, hosting that instance of Python and then having multiple users try to get to it, it's not free. There are tools that are, like something like Google Colab, which can host like a notebook for you, but then you're now in another special area of hell of helping others make sure that they, do you have a Google account? And making sure that they're set up and, you know, signed up for that kind of thing. So then it gets to the crux of it. How about we use something new and modern, in this case, Pyodide, which we've talked about WASM a lot on the show. And this is one of my favorite use cases in this example of using WebAssembly with Pyodide. Your end users, or your students in this case, can load up a web page, and then everything's going to happen in their own personal browser. And so it's a great way to get everybody, if you will, on the same page and running the same thing. And then they all can go in their different directions because it's their Python running in their browser. There's no real server side to it, which is interesting. And you're able to set it up in a variety of ways. One of the nice things about it is he's providing examples. His first example is to use a PyScript editor, which is giving you a nice little editor with syntax highlighting and so forth. And he provides an HTML snippet that you can embed as a runnable PyScript into basically any page that could be like on a static site. When it loads that part of the code, you'll see a little play button and you end up with what looks like a couple lines from inside of the REPL. And you can then import, in this case, DuckDB and try some different things out. His next example is to use a Jupyter Lite notebook, which I think we talked about briefly in a previous case. Jupyter Lite is, again, using WASM and Pyodide to be able to give you a Jupyter notebook that's running just in an individual browser. It doesn't require a lot of additional stuff server-side. And what I really liked about this example is he's providing the documentation from Jupyter Lite on how you can set this up on a GitHub page. And I thought it was really straightforward. I hadn't used GitHub pages before. I know I feel like a fossil. I haven't done that myself yet, but it's a nice service for static web pages. It's definitely, I would check it out if you haven't played around with it. It's fairly simple and it's nice because as you're committing code and so forth, it's setting it up and then hosting this page for you. In this case, you're getting a Jupyter notebook ready to go there, which is pretty cool. And then he provides the example to play with. And then there's a third way which expands on that a little bit further, which is a thing called Jupyter Lite Lab, which is more of an IDE and provides even more details on that. So now that you've taken care of Python and got that going, he details setting up the DuckDB Python client, and it is compiled to WebAssembly. You enable it using the percent sign, the sort of magic command, percent pip install DuckDB. He mentions a few of the limitations you would have with working with DuckDB in this case. or just generally of working inside of PyDiet. It is single-threaded. Remote files can be a little bit challenging. They offer a few examples and some suggestions on how to get around that. Versions of packages that you use have to be compiled toward this. And so in a few cases, that might actually be a little bit off as far as the version number. Like in the case of DuckDB, it's not version 1.1.1, it's like 1.0, which I think is fine, but it's something that you should be aware of if you're looking at the feature set. So if you are looking for to do a demonstration of Python, in this case, even going further of having a database that could run in this circumstance, or you're looking to lead a workshop or take someone through your own documentation, PyDiet in the browser is definitely a win. I was impressed with this and impressed with the idea of doing this. So check it out. Thinking about adding speech AI to your product? Join over 200,000 developers using Assembly AI's speech-to-text API with industry-leading accuracy and low latency. From podcasts to meeting recordings, Assembly AI delivers fast, reliable transcriptions with just a few lines of code. Head to assemblyai.com/realpython to get $50 in free API credits to kick off your project. No credit card required. That's assemblyai.com/realpython. What is your next one here, Christopher?
I've got a RealPython step-by-step tutorial from Leodonis Botzoromos. Still one of my favorite names to say. It's called Build a Contact Book App with Python, Textual, and SQLite. So let's start by walking through the title. Seeing as you're listening to us, I suspect you know what Python is. Textual is a TUI library. TUI stands for Text User Interface, as contrast to GUI, which is Graphical User Interface. And a TUI gives you GUI-like widgets and things like that inside of your terminal. SQLite is a single file based database. So this tutorial is about writing a contact book stored in a database and accessed through the textual TUI library. The layout of the interface is a list of contacts with action buttons on the right hand side. The buttons allow you to add new people, delete a contact, remove all contacts, that kind of stuff. The add new contact button pops up a form for the person's name, phone number, and email. And then delete pops up the sort of are you sure kind of dialogue. So you get kind of a mental image there of what this walks you through. The tutorial starts out by showing you the structure of the project you'll be building and then how to grab Textual because it is a third-party library. So you have to pip install it to get it going. And then the first thing you do is write a very simple Textual program. In order to do that, you have to inherit a app class. And by convention, this kind of thing usually happens in a file called tui.py. Inside this class, there is a compose method and an onMount method. The compose method gets called by the system when you run the program, and it needs to contain the widgets used to compose a screen. To start with, you just use built-in headers and footer widgets, and essentially that gets you to get some stuff on the screen. You can see it sort of working. The onMount also gets called automatically, and this is where you set up properties. So to start out, you add a title and subtitle property and then get those to display inside of your header. The tui.py file is where you'll define your interface, but it isn't the program's entry point. For that here, it's using a dunder main file, which allows you to invoke the program based on the package name. Inside of dunder main.py, you instantiate the app class and call its run method, which then kicks everything off. Since all you've done is define a header footer with some title, all you'll see the first time you run it is, you know, a header and footer, but you can get it going and make sure that everything's running, you got everything going. And then once you're comfortable with that, you start to add features. The next feature in the guide is to start reacting to the user. You do this by defining an action, and to start with, you'll write two, one that toggles dark mode on and off, and another that's used to exit the program. You define an action by creating a method in your app class that starts with the prefix action. And for dark mode, the method is going to be action underscore toggle dark. You then register this action against a key press by adding a bindings property to the class. This property is a list containing tuples where each tuple defines the key press action. The tuple takes the key to react to, which for this case is going to be M. M for dark, I guess. The name of the action, which here is toggle dark. You don't actually include the action prefix for the method. It does that for you automatically. And then a title for help information. So Textural already supports dark mode out of the box. So all you have to do inside of this method is flip the self.dark attribute. Once you've made these changes, you again go in, test it out, and you can make the screen all blinky by pressing M over and over and again. So the exit action could be similar. You could just press Q and have it exit. But instead, what we're going to do is add a Are You Sure dialogue. Dialogues are similar to apps in that you build them by defining classes. Instead of inheriting from app, though, you inherit from screen. Within the compose method of question dialogue, you define a grid-based layout for a label and a yes and no button. And like with actions, you tie the button press to a method in the class. Textural allows you to use CSS to do your component layout. So the next step is to create a separate CSS file that specifies how that label and those buttons fit in the dialog box. The tutorial shows you how to write just such a CSS file and tells you how to tell the app to use that file. The rest of the tutorial is similar. Piece by piece, you add parts to the screen using either the app's compose method or adding other dialog classes. You use more CSS to define the layout and tie any button presses to methods to do the work. The storage of the contact information is in an SQLite database, and this is done through the SQLite 3 library. When you get to that point of adding the contacts, the tutorial walks you through the SQL commands you need to do the create, read, update, and delete of your data in the database. So if you've never done a TUI before, this article is a great place to start. A little bit of database knowledge is probably helpful, but if you're new to SQL, you can just sort of follow the instructions and you'll be fine. So another great quality article from Leo Donis. There's plenty to learn here.
It's funny, we talk about Rich, I think pretty often on the show in the terminal. And so this is the tool that goes beyond that and gives you like full-on application stuff inside your terminal, a true text user interface. So it's fun to see us have a tutorial. And Leo Donis is a fan of GUIs. He's always been a PyQt.
Yep.
Proponent. And so it's fun to see him reach into here and play around in another environment. Well, my next one is kind of like a list of project ideas. In fact, that's what it's titled, is Django Project Ideas. We talk about Django often on the show. This is by Evgenia Verbini, and it's on JetBrains blog. It starts with this, when should I use Django section, which I think is interesting. This is a question that I get often, and I've occasionally have it within my own family. People ask me like, well, what is Python used for? And
everything.
Exactly. I try to explain that. It's like, it's everywhere. But another one is, what is Django used for? And I haven't looked it up in a long time. I haven't like kept track of what's there. I knew Instagram was always an example that people threw out there. And then various, like I knew it was, you know, originally created for particular newspapers and tools for publishing, things like that. So I went to a site that's called djangostars.com, and they had a nice list of this stuff. They had not only Instagram, but the platform Discuss, which is D-I-S-Q-U-S, which is a, you know, commenting platform you can add to your own site if you want. I did not know Spotify was using Django. I don't know if that's a previous thing or a current thing. I know YouTube started with it, which is an interesting thing. But and then the newspapers mentioning the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Guardian, and probably the most important one, the Onion. I'll use this. So
a lot of them, even the ones that started with it and aren't using it now, are still using it in like their backend tools.
Yeah,
which is why like the logos don't disappear, right? You know, even if the primary server the user's interacting with isn't that, large companies tend to stand it up for reporting or whatever inside. So think of a major brand name and there's a good chance it's there somewhere.
They might have used it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Dropbox and Pinterest were a couple other ones on there. And then, of course, I don't know if we've mentioned it on the show lately, but Real Python itself is a tool that's, you know, using it as a content management system also. So Django is very, very popular. And so the idea here is, well, what if you want to do something different with it? What are some other uses? I always thought the Django tutorial, I'm guessing it's the same. I haven't looked at it lately. I think it was a survey was the kind of design originally for the Django tutorial. And then blogs are one of the other really common ones. If you've seen like the Django Girls blog project is a really, really common one. So here is a list of other types of projects, things you can do with it. They start with giving you some resources to look at existing projects that are out there. So they mentioned a bunch of open source projects, giving you GitHub repos. Like there's one for Django packages. These are reusable apps, sites, tools, and more for using with your own Django projects, the Django project itself and the source code for Django, and then Django Social, which has code for social network and community sites that are built using Django. So those are some links to kind of get you there. And then it gets into this big list with different examples. They have, in a lot of cases, not only the idea, but also potentially a tutorial to go with it. In their first case is this air temperature app, and then it has a step-by-step tutorial. This is a JetBrains one. And then they have the Django Girls tutorial, which is creating a blog. Very common things, to-do lists, recipe organizer. And what I liked about it is, for ones that they don't have like a pure like step-by-step tutorial to go with it, they'll include what's sort of the required tech stack that you're going to need for this. So one of the examples is a survey tool. In that case, you'll probably need to use Django templates for the front end, Django forms for creating, submitting surveys, and then the Django ORM for storing the survey data. And then you may be wanting to use some kind of charting graphing library. They suggest Chart.js or D3.js for visualizing survey results, but there are other tools that might work well in that case. And then as they move into more advanced ones, the first one they mention is a multi-user classified site, and definitely is a highlight of the entire piece here, where you're building a site where multiple users can post classified ads. You'll need to create pages for listing, creating, and editing ads. And you might notice, if you see the video of this at some point, that Christopher is smiling right now because it's from his book.
For the record, you picked this article before you realized that paragraph was about me.
Yeah.
This is not payola. This is coincidence.
And to go along with that, actually, there is a recent video interview on the JetBrains YouTube channel, which is sort of a short course tutorial on using HTMX. I think it's titled, what, Discussing Django and HTMX. And in that one, you walk through a slightly different example of creating a book site that's similar to librarything.com. You're creating views, you're explaining the sort of interactivity of HTMX. And I found it really cool. And it's nice because there's a bit of an interview element to it, where Paul Everett's asking you some questions as you're going through it. And so you get a little bit deeper explanation of like how HTMX is interacting in the circumstance. So another resource I'll link to here, and another project you can kind of check out. The list of more advanced projects continues, and there's, you know, everything from interactive dashboards, stock exchange analysis, location-based recommendation systems. So a lot of these are just, you know, fodder for ideas, get you started. Several AI connected things of doing stuff with RAG or LangChain or LLMs. And I thought one of the last ones was pretty funny. One of the most crucial tools that has been a primary feature of Facebook for years, a birthday message reminder. So this is by JetBrains. So most of the examples, including Mr. Trudeau's tutorial, feature PyCharm. So be aware of that. It's, I don't think, a requirement on any of these, but a lot of the examples are showing that. So if you are unfamiliar with it, you get a chance to check out what's going on with PyCharm there. If you're needing inspiration, get started on a new project, here's a bunch of ideas and lots of thoughts on first steps on how to begin. Any commentary you want to add there, Mr. Trudeau?
Buy my book. Is that commentary?
Yeah.
All right. That's unfair. Buy my book and say positive things about it on Amazon. How's that? Is that even better? Yes.
Yeah. Well, you get to build a very, very intense project in it, the whole classifieds site. This week, I want to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. It's similar to the project that I'm sharing this week. I think tools to monitor your websites and services in Python are interesting projects to level up your skills. The course is titled Building a Site Connectivity Checker. It's based on a tutorial by Leodon Esposo Ramos, and in the video course, Darren Jones shows you how to create command line interfaces using Python's arg parse, check if a website is online using Python's http.client from the standard library, implement synchronous checks for multiple websites, check if a website is online using the AIO HTTP third-party library, and implement asynchronous checks for multiple websites. RealPython video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the enhanced search tool on realpython.com. All right, what is your next one?
So the next one I've got is called In the Making of Python Fitter and Faster, and it's by Sumer Sip. And as you might guess from the title, it's all about performance improvements in Python and covers three different things that have been going on in your favorite language for the last several releases. The first improvement they talk about is the specialized adaptive interpreter, which we've mentioned a few times in episodes before. This first got added in Python 3.11. and had additional capabilities added to it in 3.12. Recall that Python's an interpreted language, so when you run the interpreter, it's compiling your text down into bytecode, which is then what the interpreter is interpreting to execute your code. You can think of this like a mini machine in software where the instructions are things like load a value into memory. So let's say you had a function that multiplied two numbers together. The corresponding bytecode would contain five instructions. The first is resume, which does the setup for the function. The next two are loading the arguments from the function. The fourth multiplies the two values together, and the last returns the result. The multiplier operation is called binary op, and it takes multiplication as an argument. So you can kind of sort of visualize this. What the specialized adaptive interpreter does is it looks for certain patterns, especially these in loops, and does some optimization on the binary code. If you run this same function I just spoke about inside a tight loop, then look at the resulting binary code, you'll see that the interpreter has changed from before the loop to after the loop, the bytecode that's actually been done. So for example, the resume instruction changes to resume quick. This is a simpler form of resume that happens faster and skips some of the setup. Our relatively small function doesn't do a lot of fancy stuff, so it doesn't need all those steps. So what the interpreter doing here is trying to optimize that away. The next change is the calls to the load to arguments. When I said load, where are they being loaded? Well, the interpreter is stack-based. So values that you're using get pushed onto the stack, and then an operation is called, like multiply, which then reads them off the stack. So in this case, because multiple things are being put onto the stack, there's another specialization that can happen that pushes more things than once at the stack. Again, this is an optimization. And then finally, the binary op call, which does the multiplication, gets changed to binary op adaptive. This is a specialized version of the operation that tries to call a more specialized math operation. So are you adding two integers or two floats? Well, your computer has faster ways of doing that, so this call adapts. So each of these changes are dynamic, and especially for code inside of tight loops, this can make a big difference on performance. So the article covers this with an example, goes through all these little pieces, and then moves on to the next one, which is the second big change is memory management. So everything in Python is an object. Almost forgot, which means if you optimize the size of the base object, everything ends up using less memory. In fact, between Python 3.2 and 3.12, the base object went from being 352 bytes down to just 96. So this kind of memory optimization doesn't just mean that your code is smaller, which of course it is, but it often results in performance improvements as well. Smaller objects are more likely to fit in your cache, which means your CPU can get at them faster, which can make big differences on the speed of your code. And then the last change Sumer covers in this article is the new addition to Python 3.13, which is the experimental JIT. We've covered this elsewhere, so I won't go into too much detail here, but a JIT takes that bytecode that I mentioned before and translates it into machine code on the fly. This should mean faster execution because machine code's faster than bytecode, except compiling takes time, so there's always a bit of a trade-off here. Python's new JIT is copy and patch, which instead of being a full compiler, uses pre-compiled pattern templates. If it sees some of your code that matches a template, it can then quickly replace the chunk with the machine code, and instead of needing to do a full compile, merely has to fill in the references to your values. The article goes into a lot of detail here, so if you want to understand JITs and how CPython's doing it and how other languages are doing it, there's plenty to dig into. And although this last bit I'm going to talk about is actually at the top of the article, I did want to mention that Sumer talks a bit about the people who work on this behind the scenes and all these improvements. And it's a nice touch that they're, you know, doing this shout out for the folks that were all benefiting from their work and, you know, giving credit where credit is due, which I thought was a nice little inclusion.
Yeah, I think it's great that they're also including talks that go much deeper into each of these. There's a talk by Mark Shannon and a talk by Brant Booker that go into those specific areas so you can learn a little bit more. And definitely, as deep as that sounds, it seems very approachable how it's been written. And again, if you want to dive deeper, there's lots of additional links to get you further into this topic. Yeah, a lot of work happening trying to make Python fitter and faster. All right, well, that takes us into projects, I think. My one is called Tiny Status. It's a status page generated by a Python script. We had a step-by-step project on Real Python a few years back. It's another one by Leah Don Esposo Ramos, and Dara Jones turned it into a video course, so I actually might feature it as our spotlight this week. But it's building a site connectivity checker, and so there's a lot of similarity there. So if you want kind of more of a step-by-step tutorial on the types of things that you would check on something like this, it's there. Tiny Status itself is by Harry Suryapambhagya, and he has a live online demo that you can check it out. It's very customizable as far as like the page you can lay out, but you can imagine just looking at a single page application with tiles that show all the different services that you want to pay attention to, monitor these HTTP endpoints. You can ping hosts, you can check open ports. It's got a very responsive design, so you could look at it on mobile or what have you. And not only has the status page, but a little thing below it with history. You customize the checks that you're going to set up inside of it with a YAML configuration file. If you haven't practiced with setting up configurations externally from your code and loading them in, it does a lot of that stuff and uses the YAML configuration for that. It allows for, again, this sort of history tracking, and it saves that information in a markdown file, which is displayed, but also then you could, you know, pull that file down if you want to look at more details inside of it. And you can set up the status updates at configurable intervals. It supports both light and dark themes and grouping. So you can have sort of sets that you're looking at, and each of the cards is clickable, which you can set up to be optional, like if you want to have it, oh, it looks like this is down, you can click on it and go to the service, or click on it and actually see the service being up or down. So I like that it's using these YAML files for the storing the configuration. I like the fact sort of it's leaving things extensible that you can kind of grow and expand this idea again as a project. I think it's a great launching point for somebody to build something else inside of it. I think there's a lot of ideas that went into this as far as working with .env files and controlling that stuff. It gives you ability to modify a lot of different things and set them up for your particular circumstance. The variable for the type of check that you want to do, again, can be something like just a simple ping to a service, checking on a port. And then there's a much more detailed HTTP entry, which can have the host, the URL, self-signed certification, and then what kind of expected response code it should be getting in this case. So again, more inspiration for you to build your own tools. What's your project this week?
I've got a tool from Alex Povel called SRGN, pronounced surgeon. It's a funky little command line thing that is the answer to what if grep tr said and treesitter got really drunk one night and had a baby.
Okay.
Surgeon is a language aware search tool. And because it's language aware, you can do some very specific searches. So for example, rather than just looking for the instances of a string, you can look for the instance of a string that is only within a class or only within a function. So Surgeon's based on two concepts, scopes and actions. The default action is search. So if you only give it a thing to look for, it outputs to the terminal the instances it found. Surgeon supports multiple programming languages. So to work on Python files, you use --pi or as the argument, and then give it the information about the scope. The scope limits where your searching happens. So for example, say you wanted to find something within your import statements, but nowhere else, you would use the imports scope. And whatever expression you gave it would only get searched for inside of import statements. For Python, Surgeon supports scopes for comments, strings, imports, doc strings, function names, function calls, function definition blocks, async function blocks, classes, class methods, static methods, with blocks, try blocks, lambdas, global variables, variable identifiers being assigned to variables themselves. Yes, that's three different ways of left or right side of the equal statement for variables. And then types, which we won't mention because they're the evil stepchild of Python and shouldn't exist. You can also specify multiple nested scopes. So if what you're looking for is an inline import inside of a class, you can do that. The power of the scope mechanism comes from an open source library called TreeSitter, which has its own query language. So if you're up on lexical definitions, you can even write your own scopes. And because it's based on TreeSitter, this means you can do Python, but Surgeon also works with C, C Sharp, Go, Rust, and TypeScript. So pretty much most of the languages you might be out there, you can go and grab it. Surgeon itself is written in Rust, so it is compiled, but there are pre-compiled binaries, so you can just go and download it if you want, and it's available on Homebrew, and it's available as cargos and other things as well. So there's a whole bunch of different ways of grabbing it off the GitHub page. In addition to specifying the scope of the query, you can also specify an action. As I said before, the default action is searching, but you can also do modification. So one of the actions is upper, which using it turns everything that matches into uppercase. And then there's lower and title case, for example. Where it gets powerful is the replacement action, which allows you to do a search and replace kind of thing. This supports regular expressions, including groups, so you can do renames of variables or swaps or whatever else you can do with more advanced grep tools, but you can fine-tune it because you can limit where the action happens to particular scopes. Mm-hmm. So if you're someone like me who prefers the command line, Surgeon is a powerful, multi-language aware refactoring and searching tool. It's definitely worth taking a look at and playing around with.
That's the longest readme file I've seen.
Oh, it goes on forever. Yeah. I found the readme a little frustrating because it tries to give a bunch of examples in different languages. And so when you're looking for Python examples, it was sort of like, wait, but how do I do this in Python?
Yeah.
But the help on the command line is actually sorted by language. Oh, so if you actually just do the --help, there's a list of all the Python scopes, for example. So it once you've got it installed, I'd start with the --help and then maybe go back to the readme to see more advanced usages.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks for bringing all these articles and peps and projects this week. Thanks again, Christopher.
Always glad to be here.
All right. Ready to build voice-driven apps? Don't forget to claim your $50 in free API credits at assemblyai.com/realpython. I want to thank Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.